This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Well, not quite yet. Not quite yet. By way of explanation, the Mexican hat dance is apropos for the fact that yours truly is currently en route to Mazatlan, Sinaloa, for the purpose of seeing the April 8th total eclipse of the sun. Therefore, this is a pre-recorded program, although in truth, they're all basically pre-recorded. But in this case, the pre-recording took place, a good week ahead of time. And our thanks to Guy over at KDVS for putting this out on the airwaves today. We do want to note that on last week's program, or actually it was 2 weeks ago on the program, we aired an interview with one of our favorites, Jefferson Morley, Washington Post reporter. When we queried him about the special on Netflix, The Octopus Murders, actually, the title is American Conspiracy, subtitled The Octopus Murders, a story of reporter Danny Casolaro. Jeff was so dismissive of it that we didn't wind up airing his comments. But we did suggest that he check it out. Evidently, he did so, thought it was worthy. And on his JFK Facts website, he did a follow-up interview with the gentleman that put together that documentary. And that's something we highly recommend to all of you. If you saw the documentary, and we hope you did that as well, you'll find this to be an excellent supplement to the information that was presented. Anyway, for today's program, we don't expect to hear any further from Jeff Morley or any other previous guests we've had on the show, but rather we're going to use our vast archival material to round out the hour. Some of this stuff never got aired in the first place, and we think it's high time we got around to it. And some of it we enjoyed on the first pass and deem it worthy of consideration yet again. And to that end, we're going to start out with something we set aside back in 2002, which was when we began at KDVS 90.3 FM. In the fall of that year, U.S. News and World Report, a magazine we have not traditionally relied upon very much for producing this show, had an excellent double issue, a special double issue titled The Art of the Hoax. And Mr. Miller points out that April Fool's Day was just a couple days ago, so this is, I think, a double whammy for a double issue. And what surprises me, looking at this, is how many of these topics we got around to over the last couple decades, in many cases having guests discuss the topic at great length. And the topics that were cited in the magazine that we got around to later, I think I should enumerate them. Well, first, we can start out with the epic hoaxer, Alan Abel. We talked about him on this show more than once. The debunker, Michael Shermer, is cited several times, and we spoke with Michael Shermer about the supposed hoax of the moon landing. We also spoke with Phil Plait of badastronomy.com about that and other things. I think one of our favorite all-time interviews was with author Brock Yates about his book, Charlatan, which told the story of Goat Gland Brinkley, a rather notorious American doctor in the early 20th century, who claimed he could cure what was then called impotence by transplanting bits of goat testicles into the scrotums of his patients.
You mean that's a hoax?
Yeah, doesn't work. U.S. News made mention of how Juan Perón, the Argentinian dictator, faked the supposed Argentinian development of nuclear fusion power back in the 1950s. We once did a special program talking about one of the great frauds of literary history, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, something that still resonates in today's world. U.S. News went on at some length about the art of James Randi, the escapist and debunker. We were privileged to have actually been able to interview James Randi. And at one point, the story of Charles Ponzi was illuminated in the magazine, and we have made reference to him on, unfortunately, more than one occasion over the decades. But let's hit the reset button here and pull a few quotes out of this worthy effort by U.S. News. I had to enjoy the essay that they published from the epic hoaxer Alan Abel. Said Abel, last week I did 4 radio interviews spreading the word about Citizens Against Breastfeeding. This nonprofit group, which staged the first protests at the 2000 Republican convention, believes oral gratification dooms innocent infants to a life of alcohol addiction, promiscuity, and cyber sex. But frankly, I'm tired of being a spokesman. The group has, after all, been outed as a hoax. Still, interview requests keep coming as reporters chance upon www.banbreastfeeding.org. Said Abel, I've been a professional hoaxer for over 30 years. I have fun, create headlines, and kick people in the intellect. It doesn't take much to succeed as a hoaxer, an irresistible hook, some cash, and a sincere face. The media bite almost every time. America's prudishness makes sex a sure lure. The FBI compiled a 30-page dossier when I announced a Sex Olympics with finals live on stage. And TV talk shows eagerly showcased Females for Felons, a group of junior league women who volunteered to service our prisoners to aid their rehabilitation. My highest-priced deception was the 1979 mock wedding of Ugandan despot Idi Amin and an attractive wasp. To the embarrassment of folks at the State Department, I staged the nuptials. My late friend Maxwell Sackheim, founder of the Book of the Month Club, gave me $35,000 to hire an Amin lookalike and other actors and rent a suite. Amin fought with his bride-to-be. A drunken judge administered the vows. CNN and ABC ran a live feed. Hours later, newspaper editors found Amin in Africa. TV crews should have noted the date of the broadcast, which was April 1st. Occasionally, a hoax is purely personal. When a Hollywood producer was negotiating rights to my life story, I overheard his attorney tell an associate to wait till my demise. We'll deal with his estate and buy it for pennies. Infuriated, I decided to expire. My death was reported then of a heart attack in Utah while scouting a film location. The funeral home in Orem, Utah, confirmed the news. Actually, the Wellington funeral home was my friend Paul Wellington's trailer. He had no phone. I offered to pay for one if he listed himself as a funeral parlor. My obituary got 2 more inches than the inventor of the six-pack, who died the same day. The producer was eager to renew negotiations until I resurfaced. We love this guy. Back in the 1960s, he hired the then-unknown actor Buck Henry to portray the leader of a group called Cinna, which was the Society for Indecency to Naked Animals. They proposed that we clothe animals who are otherwise running around naked in the most obscene fashion. I remember some of the accompanying diagrams that were being promulgated at this time, including a horse wearing trousers and a dachshund decked out in lederhosen. The alleged motto for Cinna was, "A nude horse is a rude horse." Anyway, for more on Goat Glenn Brinkley, we refer you to our own archives at Radio Parallax and our interview with Brock Yates. If you didn't hear that in the first pass, we think you'll enjoy it. And if you did hear it in the first pass, we still think you'll enjoy it. Now, when it comes to the amazing James Randi, I have to say that he did appear at Ohlone College some years back in the Bay Area. And I was amazed at some of the tricks he did, which he frankly admitted to the audience are tricks. I'm not doing telepathy, but it sure looked like it. And of course, being a good magician, he did not reveal to the audience how the trick was accomplished. I thought of James Randi last summer when in the Week magazine, one of the last word sections included, well, this title, 50 Years of Supernatural Chutzpah. And the subheadline was, Uri Geller, infuriated and exasperated critics set on debunking his claims of psychic powers. The article was a reprint from the New York Times, a piece by David Siegel. I thought of Geller because James Randi was hell on wheels against Uri Geller. Showed how most of the things that he claimed were from psychic energy were just plain old magic tricks. The point of the article was that Geller, who was 76 last year, has survived all of his critics. There's apparently in Tel Aviv the Uri Geller Museum, which he opened back in 2021. Noted the New York Times piece, Geller was long shadowed by a handful of professional magicians, appalled that someone was fobbing off what they said were expertly finessed magic tricks as acts of telekinesis. Like well-matched heavyweights, they pummeled one another in the 70s and 80s in televised contests that elevated all of them. Opined David Siegel, Geller ultimately emerged the victor in this war, and proof of his triumph is now on display in his museum, a coffee table book titled Bend It Like Geller. And the article mentions the efforts of James Randi. Evidently, he won a MacArthur Fellowship as a professional skeptic and was the loudest anti-Geller voice in the world. He called Geller a dangerous and insidious figure, one he intended to stop at all costs. And those costs turned out to be pretty high. Geller filed defamation lawsuits against Randi, including one for claiming that Geller was performing tricks once taught on the back of cereal boxes. The so-called cornflakes case ended with a dismissal, but over the years, Randi burned through most of the $272,000 MacArthur grant covering personal legal expenses. Apparently, James Randi loathed Uri Geller to the end. He once asked someone to throw his cremated ashes into Geller's eyes. Well, we're sorry to see this viewpoint that Uri Geller has managed to outlive the efforts of James Randi to expose him. But then again, it appears we're living in a world where hoaxes have now just taken over. I've got an article I saved from 1995 taking a look at what was then called the alien autopsy hoax. Yes, somebody stitched together films supposedly of the Roswell aliens being autopsied. After referencing some of the exploits of Alan Abel, the piece said this, in 1995, mind you, a new era of vastly improved photographic hoax is also opening up. Cheap digital technology is becoming widely available. Computers can manipulate images and pictures changed to pixels or digital picture elements, and anything can be added, subtracted, or changed. Perfect fictitious images can be produced with a CD-ROM machine or a scanner, plus image manipulation software. Once stored in digital form, the original negative can be destroyed, so the hoax cannot be proven. Negatives of photos are difficult to alter undetectably, but digital images are easy. Noted the publication Investigator, in future, therefore, we can anticipate great photographic, quote, proof, unquote, of everything from angels and aliens to ghosts, monsters, and whatever. Which for something written 30 years ago certainly presages what we're seeing now in regards video, fake video, which is way more sophisticated than anything that they were talking about here in 1995. I understand there are some tells in the video that make it possible to see that it's not real, but I think that requires a rather sophisticated analysis in many cases. Late last year, The Economist weighed in on this very topic, looking ahead to election 2024. Said the magazine, tech luminaries are sounding an alarm. Eric Schmidt, a former CEO of Google, has warned that the 2024 elections are going to be a mess because social media is not protecting us from false generative AI. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, the startup behind ChatGPT and one of the leading cheerleaders for this technology, recently posted that he was nervous about the impact AI is going to have on future elections, at least until everyone gets used to it. And I should note that Ms. McMillan is a little bit less concerned about the machinations of AI than yours truly. I don't think it has anything necessarily to do with the fact that he and Sam Altman are drinking buddies. Just kidding, folks. In an editorial on this subject, The Economist said, it's important to be precise about what generative AI tools like Chatbot, GPT, do and do not change. Before they came along, disinformation was already a problem in democracies. The corrosive idea that America's presidential election in 2020 was rigged brought rioters to the Capitol on January 6th, but it was spread by Donald Trump, Republican elites, and conservative mass media outlets using conventional means. One thing that could change in 2024 is the quantity of disinformation. If the volume of nonsense were multiplied by, say, 1,000, it might persuade people to vote differently. And since we're exploring the interface between technology and politics, let's dive deeper. I would direct you, dear listener, to Real Time with Bill Maher, as Mr. Moreland directed me, to the interview with Kara Swisher on the program about her new volume titled Burn Book. She explores how it is that the good folks in Silicon Valley, well, they're thought of as liberal. Silicon Valley, certainly, I'm sure most of the people living there are, tend to be on the liberal side of things, but this does not include the tech giants' CEOs. As outlined on this program and elsewhere over the years, it's pretty apparent that social media and big tech was of great value to the political campaigning of Donald Trump, and still is. I would also direct you to the March issue of The Atlantic magazine, in the Dispatches section, article by Adrian LaFrance titled, "The Despots of Silicon Valley," is worth reading. I enjoy the way she started the piece. If you had to capture Silicon Valley's dominant ideology in a single anecdote, you might look first to Mark Zuckerberg sitting in the blue glow of his computer some 20 years ago, chatting with a friend about how his new website, the Facebook, had given him access to reams of personal information about his fellow students. Zuckerberg: "So if you ever need any info about anyone at Harvard, just ask. I have 4,000 emails, pictures, addresses." Friend: "How'd you manage that one?" Zuckerberg: "People just submitted it. I don't know why. They trust me." Dumb Fs. Noted LaFrance, Facebook, now Meta, has become an avatar of all that is wrong with Silicon Valley. Its self-interested role in spreading global disinformation is an ongoing crisis. Recall, too, the company's secret mood manipulation experiment in 2012, which deliberately tinkered with what users saw in their news feeds in order to measure how Facebook could influence people's emotional states without their knowledge. Or its participation in inciting genocide in Myanmar in 2017. Or its use as a clubhouse for planning and executing the January 6, 2021 insurrection. To a remarkable degree, Facebook's way of doing business remains the norm for the tech industry as a whole. YouTube, owned by Google, Instagram, owned by Meta, Twitter, which Elon Musk insists on calling X, have been as damaging to individual rights, civil society, and global democracy as Facebook was and is. Considering the way that generative AI is now being developed throughout Silicon Valley, we should brace for that damage to be multiplied many times over in the years ahead. What seems to really get LaFrance's goat is that the new technocrats are ostentatious in their use of language that appeals to enlightenment values, reason, progress, freedom. But in fact, they're leading an anti-democratic, illiberal movement. Many of them profess unconditional support for free speech, but are vindictive toward those who say things that do not flatter them. They tend to hold eccentric beliefs that technology progress of any kind is unreservedly and inherently good, that you should always build it simply because you can, that frictionless information flow is the highest value regardless of the information's quality, that privacy is an archaic concept, that we should welcome the day when machine intelligence surpasses our own, and above all, that their power should be unconstrained. Said LaFrance, many Americans fret rightfully about the rising authoritarianism among MAGA Republicans, but they risk ignoring another ascendant force for illiberalism, the tantrum-prone and immensely powerful kings of tech. The article mentions how last October, the venture capitalist and technocrat Mark Andreessen published on his firm's website a stream of consciousness document he called the Techno-Optimist Manifesto, a 5,000-word ideologic cocktail that eerily recalls and specifically credits Italian futurists such as F.T. Marinetti, who was quite fond of Benito Mussolini. Andreessen wrote that there's no material problem, including those caused by technology, that cannot be solved with more technology. Well, maybe not. We have to keep in mind here that these Ayn Rand fans, these so-called libertarians that run Silicon Valley, really have a very, very elevated opinion on themselves and the people they want to surround themselves with. LaFrance notes that Andreessen takes the reasonable position that technology on the whole has dramatically improved human life and warps it to reach the absurd conclusion that any attempt to restrain technological development under any circumstances is despicable. LaFrance notes that these Ayn Randian ideas of these Silicon Valley giants absolve them of any moral or civic duty to do anything but make new things that will enrich them without considerations of the social cost or of history. Andreessen identified a list of enemies and zombie ideas that he calls upon his followers to defeat, among them institutions and tradition. Our enemy, Andreessen wrote, is the know-it-all credentialed expert worldview, indulging in abstract theories, luxury beliefs, social engineering, disconnected from the real world, delusional, unelected, and unaccountable, playing God with everyone else's lives with total insulation from the consequences, said LaFrance. The irony is that this description very closely fits Andreessen and other Silicon Valley elites. Anyway, she concludes by noting that we do not have to live in the world that the new technocrats are designing for us. We do not have to acquiesce to their growing prospect of dehumanization and data mining. Says the author, no more build it because we can, no more algorithmic feedbacks, no more infrastructure designed to make the people less powerful and the powerful more controlling. Well, I certainly agree with her sentiment. We'll see how this goes. This same issue of The Atlantic also has a piece by Caitlin Tiffany titled Meet Me in the Eternal City, which is worth a minute or two of. Now, a bunch of Silicon Valley elites have been buying land in Solano County in California to build a rather utopian city that they envision will just be, well, it'll be custom designed by them for them. The article notes that in 1995, in a famous essay, The California Ideology, British academics Richard Babruck and Andy Cameron explained that the technologists of Silicon Valley look forward to a future in which existing political, social, and legal power structures will wither away to be replaced by unfettered interactions between autonomous individuals and their software. This kind of reminds me of how the communists thought that the state would eventually wither away. Peace notes that the authors observed dryly that California's highways, universities, and extensive public infrastructure had all been built by complex bureaucracies and funded by taxes. Well, it's pretty clear that Peter Thiel and the other giants in Silicon Valley are not too fond of taxes, even though an awful lot of the infrastructure that has gone into the World Wide Web and the Internet and all the companies in Silicon Valley came through the government, which is supported by taxes and also, of course, borrowing gobs of money. But that's a topic for another day. Apparently, to build their utopias, some of these guys have been traveling around the world trying to find a receptive country that would let them test out their ideas. They're apparently working on Montenegro at the moment. But apparently, there's a bunch of them in places like Honduras and Nigeria. Caitlin Tiffany notes that these projects are pitched with a sense of grandiosity and grievance, saying the twisted bureaucracy of democratic governance is constraining humanity. Decades ago, we went to the moon. Why don't we have flying cars? Centuries ago, we praised frontiersmen and pioneers. Why are they vilified now? Why all this disdain for the doers and the builders? Why all this red tape in the way of the best and the brightest? Most of these projects are not yet real to the point of treaties or cement, but they're real enough in the minds of people who wield in a powerful, tight-knit industry. These people are energetic, creative, and sometimes charming, and they have their hearts set on a future that belongs to them alone. Notes The Atlantic, in this new age, computers would alter every institution, the very structure of society, and the entire world economy. In doing so, they would imperil national governments by curtailing their power to control citizens and collect taxes. They would also create a permanently wealthy superior class, a cognitive elite, whose members may exist in the same physical environment as the ordinary subject citizens, but who would never again regard ordinary citizens as their equals. We've argued on this program in the past that one of the most notable contributions that tech is making to the world is to create unemployment. People are being displaced by machines because, well, in the end, the machines are cheaper. They save a lot of money for America and the world's corporations, which makes the CEOs very happy. It makes them very, very pleased with the products that they are picking up from Silicon Valley. But if everybody is losing their job to be replaced by machines, you have to wonder out loud how long that trend can continue without problems developing. I know this sounds like Luddite thinking, you know, people who are against progress, but, well, if we had time, we'd go into the actual history of the Luddites, but we don't. What's different today, I think, is the pervasive nature of how it is these technologies are reaching out all around the world to displace humans and jobs. You know, we've talked before about getting Tim Wu in this program to talk about his perspective on all this, and by God, Ms. Millen, we really need to do that. Something we also need to really do is take a break. I think we're overdue for one, frankly. I'm Douglas Everett. This is Radio Parallax, and let's take a few minutes and hit the reset button.